You know what you're listening to?
Is that a trick question?
It's the I Still Love This Game podcast with your host, Matthew Damien.
He's an idiot. Don't listen to this. He's an idiot.
Hello and welcome to episode 40 of the I Still Love This Game podcast. This is actually the fifth podcast in 7 days, but I'm sure you haven't come here to listen to that fact. You want to hear some playoff analysis, and there's quite a few good games today in day two, of the NBA playoffs. And I'm going to begin with the game that just finished, and that was the Rockets and Timberwolves. An absolute classic. James Harden was incredible. 44 points and carried his team in a close game down the stretch against a team that has very capable defenders on the perimeter. Honestly, this is what you expect from an MVP, and this is what MVP talent does. They will recognize what their team needs, and they deliver. They don't stand pat and scream at their teammates whilst they themselves are underperforming. LeBron James. But getting back onto Harden, honestly, this might be a little bit controversial, but I'm going to run with this for a bit. When I started to rank the top 50 players of all time, which is an upcoming book that I'm going to be doing, I wrote that James Harden has the potential of being a top 5 shooter of all time. But after what I've seen this season and what I just saw in Game 1, I think he's the best shooter in all of basketball right now. And you might be thinking, whoa, hold on a second, what about Steph Curry, what about Klay Thompson, what about Kevin Durant, all on one team, by the way. And that's a big reason why I think James Harden is the best shooter in the game right now. Because you think about pretty much every shot he has on him, he's contested. The defense is tight, he's the focal point of the opposing team's defense. And a lot of the time down the stretch, he doesn't have help from a screen situation and getting a mismatch. Sometimes I'll run a high screen and roll and force a mismatch onto a big. But a lot of the times they just let him go ISO. What does that tell you about how good of a shooter this man is? They will, because typically the best defender, the best perimeter defender will be on him anyway, like Jimmy Butler was today. And they'll be like, okay, just go to work. Do it. We'll just clear out for you and we still trust your ability to take that shot. And more times than not, one of two things will happen. He will end up burying a long jumper, which will either be a three or a deep two, or he'll get to the rim. But getting to the rim is secondary to him. That's because his defender will press up on him so tightly that he can easily just get to the rim. So I think he's the best shooter in all of basketball right now. And as I said, I know that's controversial. I'm not trying to be controversial, but I can't ignore that anymore. I can't without saying it, because someone else will come up if I'd say it, and I'll be looking like I've copied them. But no, I think James Harden is the best shooter and clearly the best scorer in NBA. There's no question whether he's the best scorer, but in terms of just shooting ability, I think he's the best in the NBA at that as well. Now, before the series started, I thought that Minnesota had an advantage in the front court and they should be able to hit the glass pretty well with Karl-Anthony Towns, Gibson, and Wiggins. You didn't really see that. And I would like to see them, especially if PJ Tucker is guarding Gibson. I want to see Gibson hit the glass a lot more, and I want to see them actually run some plays for Gibson in the low post. I mean, but that realistically, we're not really going to see that, because you don't even see them running plays for Karl-Anthony Towns in the post. So I don't think there's a whole lot of hope in seeing Gibson getting the ball on the block. And I guess the thing, if you're Minnesota, you're caught between a rock and a hard place, because you've got this advantage on the glass if you use it, on the offensive glass, but if they crash the offensive glass and they don't get the board, that plays right into Houston's hands, because they can push on every miss in that situation. And Houston loves to play at that pace. So maybe sporadically see them hitting the glass, but you don't want to be doing that all game, not against this team, not with this offensive depth that they have as well, where they can go all game. It's not just James Harden and Chris Paul pushing. You got Gordon. You got a lot of offensive playmakers that love to play that transition pace. And if you got Minnesota sending their front court to crash the boards, you're leaving Jimmy Butler, assuming that he's not crashing the boards as well, and Jeff Teague and Derrick Rose and guys like that in no man's land up against 3-on-2. It's hard enough to stop these guys 5-on-5 in the half court, let alone on a 3-on-2 break. What Minnesota could also consider is actually putting Dang or even Wiggins on Capella. And that's especially in transition, because the rim running of Capella completely tore up Minnesota in the first half. They need to do something about that, because if it's not James Harden, it's Chris Paul. If it's not Chris Paul, it's Eric Gordon. If it's not Eric Gordon, then you've got other players on the perimeter like Gerald Green or Joe Johnson that are capable. And then if you don't, if that's not working, then you've got Clint Capela on top of all of it. At some point, you've got to give up something. But if you, Capella's not going to really be a threat in the post. And maybe, just maybe, if PJ Tucker is out there, Karl-Anthony Towns is better suited guarding something like that, even out on the perimeter, than he is guarding Capela. And quite honestly, this shouldn't be a surprise to anybody, because if you watched a lot of Houston Rockets games this season, you'd have seen Clint Capela was a borderline all-star. And I'm saying that with a straight face. He played fantastic this season. If it wasn't for Oladipo, and believe me, we'll get to Oladipo in this episode, but if it wasn't for Oladipo's emergence, Clint Capela probably would have run away with the Most Improved Player of the Year award. Boy, that's a mouthful of a sentence. But regardless, I think Karl-Anthony Towns, he's not really suited to guard Capela, either in transition or in the half court. And maybe someone like Wiggins, who's athletic, he's a little bit shorter than Capela, but Capella's game is based off athleticism, whether it's screen and rolls or just offensive rebounds. Maybe someone like Wiggins or Deng would be better suited. And you can somewhat hide Karl-Anthony Towns up against a PJ Tucker. Now, you could run into problems if they move Tucker to the bench and you bring in a Joe Johnson, or you bring in a Gerald Green, and all of a sudden he's on an island and he has to guard, say, Ariza, because if they bring in Eric Gordon. So if you've got a lineup of Capela, Gordon, Ariza, Chris Paul, James Harden, then I don't like that situation at all for Karl-Anthony Towns to be guarding those perimeter guys. But if you've got a choice of putting Karl-Anthony Towns on PJ Tucker or Capela based off game one, I'm going to put him on PJ Tucker and make PJ Tucker make plays from the perimeter. But overall, if you're Minnesota, I don't think you're totally discouraged by this loss. They very nearly beat the best team in the NBA this season at home in the playoffs, and it took an incredible performance from James Harden to get them over the line. Now, the flip side of all that is James Harden and Capela had great performances, but Chris Paul, he was back to his playoff mode. He was terrible. In fact, all the Rockets were terrible outside of Capela and Harden. Let's just look at the production. Capela and Harden combined 25 of 41 from the field and only had 3 turnovers between them. The rest of the Rockets, 14 of 42 and 8 turnovers. Chris Paul had 6 of those 8 turnovers. So if you're Minnesota, you're looking at it like, okay, we just had a hell of a performance. We just took a hell of a performance by both Capela and Harden, and we very nearly won. But also, if you're Minnesota, you have to be realistic too, and flip it around as well and think, okay, Trevor Ariza, Joe Johnson, Chris Paul, Eric Gordon aren't going to play that bad again. So you've really discovered the standard of what it's going to take to win multiple games in this series. Whether they can sustain that and be consistent is another question to ask altogether. I still think Houston's going to win in 5. I think the other guys will step up. James Harden, what great leadership that he showed in this game. That's the standard that the Rockets now have to live up to. All those guys that have championship aspirations on this team, they now know what needs, that they have to follow James Harden and the example that he's setting. And believe me, I never thought I'd be saying those words 2 or 3 seasons ago, when I thought James Harden should have been traded after they were bouncing the first round and Kevin McHale was fired and JB Bickerstaff has essentially just walked out on them after they were swept, or not swept, but they lost in 5 games to the Warriors. We're going to stay in the Western Conference and we're going to talk about the game that preceded this, and that was the Thunder versus the Jazz. An absolute avalanche of threes by Oklahoma. The Thunder made 14 out of 29 from threes, and Paul George had 8 of 11 himself. And if you're Utah, you've got to be somewhat concerned by that, because do they have the defensive consistency on the perimeter with guys like Rubio and Joe Ingles to actually stop players when they get hot, whether it's Carmelo in the first quarter or Paul George in the second half? Who can they throw at them? I would actually like to see Utah use Exum a little bit more, as well as Crowder a little bit more, because they're much better defensively. And if that's at the expense of Ricky Rubio and Joe Ingles, then so be it, because I don't think these guys can stop Oklahoma once they get rolling. And this is what I was trying to say in the playoff preview podcast, is this, that's what makes Oklahoma such a tough matchup for teams in the playoffs, because you can get away with cheating on defense and going underneath screens and leaving guys open in the regular season because it's one game. But in the playoffs, you're going to get exposed. I know this is just one game, but how are they going to make these changes? And I think, honestly, all they can do is bring in some more of their defensive firepower, as I said, the Crowders and the Exums. But can these guys play 35, 40 minutes a game? I don't think so. Not at this level, and not, and honestly, on offense, they will be liabilities as well now. So if you're Utah, and I don't want to underestimate Utah, because I've really enjoyed how they played in the second half of the season, but Utah's best chance might be to just simply hang around and be within striking distance in case Oklahoma starts to beat themselves, essentially, and implodes. You know, that's never a good formula, but because of the talent discrepancy, that might be their only hope. The other thing I want to see them do is, much like what I said about Minnesota against Houston, they have to look to their foreman a little bit more and go down to Derek Favors. Derek Favors, if he's guarded by Carmelo Anthony, clear out, put him on the block, and let him go to work, and then you force the Thunder's defense to collapse, and then you get wide open looks for your shooters. That makes a lot more sense than just trying to run high screens for Mitchell, and he's going up against Corey Brewer or Westbrook or Paul George, obviously. These guys are quality defenders. That's not a good situation if you're Utah. Get the ball in Favors' hands and understand the weaknesses that they have. Also, what I'd like to see is Westbrook is getting a lot of defensive rebounds the last few last week. He's been getting a lot of criticism for that as well. But whoever Westbrook is guarding, hit the glass. Just start crashing. Make him work and make him box out rather than getting these uncontested rebounds. Make him work for that. And then what it will do is it will cause him to use up a little bit of energy. You can also pressure him in the backcourt so he doesn't get a full head of steam. And it might just slow down or shift the pace from what we saw in game one. But despite the loss, Utah did score nearly 110 points. It was 108 on the road against a pretty good team in Oklahoma. If they make those three changes and two of them are successful, they can easily tie this series up. The problem that they have in this series is the first point I made. You know, they could make all the changes in the world, but at the same time, they just don't have the defensive talent to really slow down these guys, Paul George and Russell Westbrook, if they're on. If they're on, there's not a whole lot most teams can do in that in those circumstances. And I think Utah might be in a little bit of trouble here. But also keep in mind, Oklahoma plays with a lot more confidence at home in the playoffs than they do on the road. So let's see what happens when Oklahoma goes into Utah before we think that this series is over. Let's switch it over to the Celtics and Bucks. And I woke up at 3:30 in the morning to watch this one, and I was not disappointed. What an unbelievable finishes. One of the best final minutes I've ever seen. And quite honestly, maybe the best first round final minute I've seen in ever. I mean, I can't think of a better final minute of a first round game that I've seen. I've seen better finishes in conference finals games and NBA finals games, but not in the first round. That was incredible to watch. Rozier's shot, the one, the step back one that we thought was the game winner in the end of regulation, that reminded me a lot of Kemba Walker's famous step back in college when he was playing at UConn. And Middleton's shot was just a pure miracle. Maybe we should call him Miracleton. Yeah, okay, I'll let myself out after that. That was pretty bad. But that was such a fun last minute of action. Last 20 seconds, really, was just fantastic. And it got me thinking, and I actually wrote this down because, as I said, it was really early in the morning, and I usually never make notes for this stuff, but I made this note. And it reminded, and I wanted to make sure that I mentioned it in this episode, is this series is very reminiscent, and I know it's only one game, but it's very reminiscent so far in terms of the circumstances of that Bulls and Celtics series. I think it was in 2009, the year after the Celtics won, and Kevin Garnett was injured, just like Kyrie Irving's injured now. You got a young team emerging in Milwaukee. You had a young team emerging in Chicago with Tyrus Thomas and Derrick Rose. They were young at that stage. Of course, you had older players too, like Heinrich, and Joachim Noah was a young player as well. But you had Heinrich, and you had and Ben Gordon as well. Luol Deng, I believe, was on that squad as too. So you had a nice little mix, just like you've got a nice little mix with Milwaukee. And the sad point of all this as well is when I was watching that series in 2009, and this is why I think the Clippers and Spurs were actually a better first round series than the Bulls and Celtics. Even though that Bulls and Celtics, like, well, there was what, 7 or 8 overtimes combined in that first round, because you had a triple overtime game. But you got the feeling that whoever was going to advance wasn't going to go to the conference finals or the NBA finals. And unfortunately, it has the same vibe. There's no way I think that either team will even get to the conference finals. And if they do get to the conference finals, well, I can't see them beating Toronto, or we got to put Indiana in this conversation now after what's happened, or Cleveland. But from a pure basketball competitive standpoint, forget about the context of which team could advance. This could be an absolute classic. Now, if you're Boston, it was so important that they were able to recover and win this in overtime, because had they had lost this game in overtime after, you know, Rozier's shot, I think, you know, we could be talking about a sweep. I don't think they could have recovered, especially with the age of some of their players. And it took 5 guys scoring 20 points to win this game. It was pretty much all their starters, with the exception of Aaron Baines, and you take him out for Morris, and Morris got the bulk of his minutes anyway. Morris hit some huge shots. He's developed so well for them. I remember when he was a rookie and he was playing with his twin, and we thought, oh, you know, he's just a fringe role player. He's had his moments where he's been a very impactful player on big, big games. And I've got to give it to him, because I never really rated him to make the kinds of shots that we've seen him make this season and in game one. What an incredible player that has bottled his game up, and when the moments are brightest and his team needs him, he comes through. I if I wasn't holding a microphone right now, I'd give him a standing ovation. And the same with Rozier. All the hype was around Kyrie Irving, and Rozier comes in and completely shuts down Eric Bledsoe. And when you look at the development of whether it was Isaiah Thomas or Kyrie Irving emerging as an MVP candidate for most of the year until he was injured, and now we see Rozier, Brad Stevens knows how to get the most out of his point guards. He knows how to get the most out of every single one of his players. You know, I said it was out of Nate McMillan or Snyder for Coach of the Year, but then I watch a game like this, I think, man, Brad Stevens... if I had a franchise and I had the choice of any coach, how could you look past Brad Stevens after what we've seen this season? But I'm still confident in Milwaukee winning this series, because, as I said, it took 5 guys scoring 20 points for them to escape at home with a victory, and that's with Bledsoe playing really bad. I know Middleton had a big game. Giannis obviously had a big game as well. But you've really got, when you have the best player on the court by far in terms of talent in Giannis, you know, I'm not sure if at some point the Boston role players won't step up. And when I say step up, the step up to the level that they just did step up to. And I think Boston's going to run into all kinds of troubles there, because can you rely on Al Horford or Morris to get you out of those spots all the time? Can you rely on a second year player like Jaylen Brown or Tatum to get you out? If you can, then they've got something real special, because next year they're going to be adding Kyrie Irving and Gordon Hayward to the mix. And then potentially whatever pieces they may add during the offseason. Because don't forget, they've got a semi-decent draft pick coming their way as a result of the Fultz trade. Remember, they had the number one pick in the draft. They traded down to the number 3 pick, and Philly had to throw in, I think it was the Lakers pick. So they'll have a top 10 selection, probably, in their back pocket that they could use to either draft another player, and they've shown that they're pretty good at drafting players recently, or to use it as trade bait. So they're going to be a powerhouse next year. Just how much of a powerhouse, we don't know. This could be a dynasty if Jaylen Brown and Tatum become consistent playoff performances, along with Morris, along with Horford, along with Kyrie Irving, along with Gordon Hayward. That's a lot, especially in the East. But as it pertains to this series, I cannot buy it for the life of me that all 5 guys that produced for Boston today will all produce. And all it will take is one to not produce, and Eric Bledsoe to play a little bit better. And believe me, there's a lot of room for improvement after that game, and play a little bit better, and they should run away this series. And the final game that I wanted to talk about, well, I really didn't even want to talk about it, was the Pacers and Cavs. And what a disappointing performance by the LeBron-led Cavaliers. This was an amazing start, though, by the Pacers. I don't want to underestimate or understate what they did. Cleveland looked completely disinterested, and quite honestly, it gave me flashbacks to the 2011 first-round series between the New Orleans Hornets. They were the Hornets at that stage, and the Lakers, and this is where Chris Paul was running circles around everyone. The Lakers survived that series in six games, but game one was a blowout for the Hornets. And then in the next series up against the Mavericks swept the Lakers. And everybody was saying that, you know, the Lakers were burnt out. You know, three straight finals appearances, two straight titles. You know, does this sound familiar at all? Well, the difference between the Cavs and that Lakers team is that Cleveland has brought in plenty of fresh legs and hungry players too, that you would expect to be hungry, chips on their shoulders. So there's no real, they can't really use that excuse. Of course, LeBron's had a lot of mileage on his tires, and same with Kevin Love. But if you're LeBron and you're apparently trying to chase the greatest player of all time, and guess what? Jordan had a lot of mileage on his tires too, and you never saw him put up performances and stink up the joint in the first round of the playoffs like this. That was, when you look at talent, you cannot tell me that this, if you just line up both teams and put them on a neutral court even, you line up both teams and the Indiana Pacers are 20 points better in terms of talent than what the Cavaliers are. And for your leader to be completely demolished by Oladipo, and Oladipo is playing fantastic. He's had a great year, as I mentioned when I was talking about Clint Capella. Clint Capella has no chance of most improved player of the year. Nearly every other year, he would be a shoo-in for that award. But that tells you how good Oladipo was. You know, you could even make an argument that Oladipo deserves to be in the top 10, maybe the top 15 would be a little bit fairer in terms of MVP candidates. And he should, by all accounts, be considered for All-NBA third team, which is saying a lot when you look at how stacked the guard position is in the NBA. But the point that I was trying to make about LeBron is there's no excuses. They were crushed. They were absolutely crushed. And now the question is, can they recover? And they don't have a choice. If they get blown out in game two, this series is over. I don't care what kind of heroics you may be expecting. If they go down two games to none against a Pacer team that's surging, you can pretty much write that off. Even if they do recover, if they're tired now, imagine what they're going to be tired after at least a 6 or 7 game series against the Pacers. Then they've got to go through the Raptors. And the Raptors, the way that they played in game one, that could be a short series against Washington. So we didn't see desperation. We didn't see intensity. We didn't see any desire out of the Cavs in game one. We better see it in game two, or else they could be done, if not in this series, definitely the next series. Now, in terms of changes, the only change you can maybe do is bring in J.R. Smith and have him play more minutes, because he seemed like the only player that actually gave a you-know-what in this game. The other thing to keep an eye out on, and I hate to say this, but I did see it in Game 1, and I feel compelled to talk about it now, is the inconsistencies in officiating. And what I mean by that is, you've heard the term 50-50 calls, and once the Pacers jumped out to a huge lead, you saw nearly every 50-50 call go towards Cleveland, and nearly every 50-50 call go against the Pacers. It would make me sick to my stomach if that's an indication of what we're going to get for the rest of the series, in order to make sure that LeBron doesn't lose in the first round of the playoffs, and that's intact. So just keep an eye on that. It's definitely a possibility. I'm not going to say that, you know, it's definitely going to happen, but it's a possibility. So just watch for it. Try to keep an open mind with it. We've got two games coming up tomorrow, and that's the first game is the 76ers versus Miami. I'm kind of torn between who I think will win that game, because obviously we saw Philly blow them out in the second half of game one. But I'd be very surprised if they're able to maintain that dominance in game two. So I think it will be a bit closer, but I think Philly will just get over the line because of the home court, and they just have a little bit too much depth offensively. And the other game is San Antonio versus Golden State, and I think Golden State handles that game quite convincingly. Thanks so much for listening, guys. Enjoy the games. The next podcast should be not after tomorrow's games, but after the next day's games. And so we'll have four games to talk about once again, as well as anything else that comes up. Thanks for listening. Take care, and I'll catch you next time.